from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forums next hour, Ramona Pearson was a 22-year-old Marine when she was hit by a drunk driver and landed in a coma. When she woke up 18 months later, she was blind and unable to walk or speak. She went on to become a champion cyclist and rock climber while still blind. She later regained her sight and became an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley and is now head of a startup called Declara, which develops technology for customized learning tools. We'll talk to Ramona Pearson as part of our first-person series profiling Bay Area innovators and leaders who make our region unique. That's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. And this hour, as part of our ongoing first-person series, we meet Ramona Pearson. Today, she is a leading successful Silicon Valley executive, CEO of a company called Declara, which she founded in 2012. She's had careers as an education innovator, aviator, neuropsychologist, and more recently, software developer. And she also became a champion cyclist and a rock climber. She did that while she was blind, and therein lies the truly extraordinary part of her story. April 1984, as a young Marine, she was walking her dog, and a drunk driver ran a red light, hit and ran over her. Her dog died, and she became blind as a result after being in a coma for 18 months. Her chest and her throat were ripped open. The driver actually ran over her legs. She weighed 64 pounds, and after numerous surgeries, including a surgery on her eyes, which actually was a robotic surgery, she had to relearn how to breathe, how to eat, how to walk and see. And we welcome you to the Forum program. Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It's thrilling.
It's an inspiring and amazing story. And you are kind of a bionic woman still, a lot of titanium and everything. Huh?
Yeah. You know, in fact, I always joke that at the end of my life, they'll melt me down and turn me into a titanium bike.
Well, you were also, and I was introduced to a term I was unfamiliar with, what they called a gomer, get out of my emergency
room. Yes. Yeah. You know, I spent so much time in the hospital. So after my accident, I was in the hospital for about 3 years.
And in many respects, the prognosis wasn't good. I mean, there must have been something left in you to be Humpty Dumpty, some kind of fight or resilience, which is what makes your story so amazing. Many people would have perished having gone through what you went through.
You know, there were several things. One, I was a young person. Number two, I had been running marathons for the Marine Corps. So also in the Marine Corps, you know, they really instill a sense of grit. And I think that that has persevered in everything that I've done in my life.
How many surgeries did you actually go through?
So early on, probably a little bit more than 53, and then I've had dozens since to make sure put my face back on, and sometimes I look in the mirror and I see parts of my buttocks on my face, and I can joke about that, but you know, maybe close to 70, 80, maybe more. I stopped counting, but you know, periodically I have to go in and have different body parts replaced still because the titanium or some plastic or metal piece just break off or have to be changed out.
Really amazing in awe of just your resilience and your attitude and all this. Your dog died, and you were blind for a considerable length of time. You've said publicly that having a guide dog changed your life.
Yeah, you know, when I got hit by the drunk driver, probably I was actually running, and the drunk driver had hit me on the side where my dog was. Had she not been on that side, I would have been dragged underneath the car, and instead she took the brunt of the hit. So when I had the opportunity to get a guide dog, it was a German Shepherd. Her name was Annie. And she did two things for me. One was help me recover a sense of loss that I had. And number two, it helped me with being able to reconnect with society because it's really hard to interact with other people when you have a cane, a white cane that's between you and others. And Annie would often walk me into a restaurant and sit me at any open chair with families or other people. And I'm sure they were shocked to see some blind person come and join their table. But it opened up the world for me in so many ways.
So did being in an adult learning facility in Colorado. And I want to talk to you about that because that was obviously a seminal experience for you. But you know what happened to the driver who hit you?
You know, I never really followed up in that. I know that from records and everything that he had been charged with vehicular assault. But for me, I always look forward and not back because, you know, I sometimes when you have these horrible things happen to you, you have two choices. One is to be bitter and try to replay things, but you can't take it back. You can't change the past. All you can do is change the path that you're on.
But he was arrested and he was prosecuted and he was clearly drunk.
He was a drunk driver.
So you wound up at this actually kind of senior center in Colorado, which was, as I said, a major experience. In fact, when you were talking about the cane, I think you learned a lot from the wisdom of these older people, including somebody who said to you, you were afraid about crossing a street when you were blind, and somebody said, just stick out your cane, right?
Yes. Yeah, you know, imagine, so I must have landed and looked like E.T. had come and visited the senior center because by the time I landed at their doorstep, I was 68 pounds, completely bald, couldn't speak. I didn't have any cane skills and or ability to do anything, and the senior citizens really wrapped around me. So imagine having 100 grandparents that were focused just on you and nothing else. For one, they kept my life busy because every hour of every day was focused on them trying to figure out how to bring me back and with a sense of humor and helping me be able to laugh at some of my shortcomings, which helped me recover even faster, I think. And you're exactly right. When I had to confront crossing a street and tried to figure out how I was going to cross the street, the best alternative to being afraid was stick the cane out and see if a car was there.
Well, they also, in helping you reorient yourself to life, didn't they have playing Scrabble with cuss words?
Yes, we called it cuss word Scrabble. And the gentleman, you know, they brought this in because I was an adult and I felt very self-conscious about relearning how to speak. And this plays into a lot of what we do with Declara and bring the playfulness of learning and bring the human piece of learning into the technology. And you know, it's very hard to be an adult and try to learn how to time your lips with your tongue and grabbing air and holding air and moving your throat again and uttering a new word and having it all make sense. And when you're a child doing that, you know, you're practicing with goo goo gaga, you know, all of these different sounds. You don't feel self-conscious, but as an adult, sounding like a baby, it was really painful emotionally for me. So the men felt like, well, let's figure this out and make it playful and fun. And so they helped me overcome a lot of obstacles with bringing in humor and jokes.
And we'll talk more about what happened vis-a-vis Declara and your entrepreneurial career, your career in Silicon Valley, but the biggest change, you said, was looking down at your hands.
Yeah, you know, when I had to have brain surgery, and they were able to bring the sight back in my left eye. I received a cornea from somebody who had passed away and donated their cornea, and they reattached my retina. And so when I started to have my sight back, I remember trying to remember what things looked like because I had my memory trace of what things were had started to disappear. But when I looked at my hands and saw that I had aged and, you know, more than 10 years, and it's shocking because in some ways you're thinking that time isn't moving for you. So it was unnerving to realize that time kept marching on for me.
You talk about just what you learned from being blind, and what you learned from being blind had a lot to do with the relearning process. I mean, when you became sighted, and you said also you picked up some bad habits.
Yes, I had picked up a lot of bad habits. You know, there are a lot of pieces in your question there that are very interesting. As a blind person, so when I learned to be a blind person and learned how to eat and shop and organize my shelves and learn Braille, I had to relearn everything as a blind person. I built cognitive maps of everywhere I was and counted all of my footsteps, even with a guide dog, and tried to build a textile map of the world. And then when I got my sight back, I had to relearn everything all over again. And I had some oddities where I thought, well, if I don't want to be seen by somebody as a blind person, I thought, well, I just need to duck so no one could smell me. And of course, I'm sure that looked ridiculous. And when I'd tie my shoes, as a newly blind person, I bent over one time when I was sitting and smashed my head on the table because I hadn't learned that I needed to put my hand out and understand what was in my space. And then getting my sight back, it was revealing that I had a very strange consciousness of what the world looked like and that some of my cognitive maps were off a little bit.
And you learned a lot from that. I mean, a lot that became applicable to what would be a career in Silicon Valley, which I want to talk with you about. But first, let's go back to Colorado for a moment, because you've referred to that whole experience as, and it also contributed certainly to your success, entrepreneurial and technology success, extreme radical collaboration.
Yes. You know, I bring that up because I had the opportunity to relearn everything from having people invested in my life, and these people had to assess everything that I needed. They did essentially a gap analysis without really having the term for it, seeing what I had, what my strengths were, and what my weaknesses were. And I think my failings in the hospital were we didn't have all of these people who had all of these talents and skills come together to really piecemeal my life back together. So in senior homes, you have people who used to be doctors or mayors or bankers or chefs or cooks or teachers. And so in one space, I had people who had all of the skills that I needed for my life. And they came together and really pulled me back together again. And so Declara became this tool that allows us to bring crowdsourcing into learning so that we don't look at one mentor or one set of content or courses and curriculum to try to help people learn. We bring a series or a set of people with expertise to your learning.
A collaborative learning notion, but also a notion that really makes me think about all of the use of so-called senior citizens who often are warehoused, you know, in terms of being socially constructive and being adding to all kinds of educational realms. But let me get the trajectory of this, because you were involved in neuropsychology. You called yourself a math and tech geek, also a data geek. I mean, what was the line that led you to Silicon Valley and to essentially becoming an entrepreneur? How did that all evolve?
You know, it wasn't a straight path here. Actually, I went back. I really wanted to be a cardiologist, but nobody wanted a blind surgeon. So because that's what I wanted to be while I was in the Marine Corps, I had planned to go back to school and become a heart surgeon. When I realized as my life came back together that wouldn't happen, I decided to get into the neurosciences. And I was working on bringing together a lot of the mathematics of PET and CAT and other types of technologies so that we could create a three-dimensional view of the brain and really think about best surgical pathways to lesions or to shrapnel. and started to build a neuroassessment overlay so that we could personalize the pathways to surgery so that people could have choices in retaining certain cognitive behaviors that could be impacted in surgery. And a lot of that ended up helping me think through education. So I was starting to work in some of the learning and memory clinical trials at the VA. And when I had the opportunity to visit a school, I fell in love with education and thought I needed to get my teaching credentials so that I could speak the language of an educator and really understand the struggles and needs of educators in helping their students. Because imagine being a teacher and you're faced with 120 or more students every day and not having the tools you need to be able to really profoundly affect the learning trajectory of all these students. And so I really wanted to be commit my life to that because so many people had committed their lives to me.
So again, we go back to the Colorado experience, the idea mm-hmm. of learning and relearning, of personalized learning, of adult learning, of mentoring, all those kinds of things coalescing, really, yeah?
Right. In fact, I am a person that basically reflects, the modern lifelong learner, that there are no careers today that don't require us to be a lifelong learner. All of us have to plug back into our learning trajectory because our jobs, our businesses, the careers are constantly in flux and changing, and nobody stays in jobs 20 years or more anymore. And technology is changing so quickly that we have to rethink what education means and how we educate our educators so that they're facilitators of learning and that we continue to enrich their learning and their lives so that they can build lifelong learning students. And I'm also the product of innovation and all the technologies of putting me back together again. So my eye, my brain, my nose, my face, my leg, my heart, my throat have all been put together by some startup, some innovator, some person who took a risk to invent something.
Ramona Pearson is our guest this hour. She's CEO of Declara. They're a Palo Alto-based company that uses a tech platform to personalize learning. And actually, before Declara, there was Synaptic. That was a company that you sold, I believe, in 2010 for a pretty tidy sum. Tell us about that.
So Synaptic Mesh grew out of the fact that I had focused on education. I moved up into Seattle and actually worked as an educator, an assistant principal. I became a district administrator and helped manage education technology, research assessments, and sometimes athletic directing. If anybody understands education, sometimes you end up taking on other parts of the district that you don't expect. Anyway, I built a large data warehouse there and a learning management system called the Kids, called the Source. And we started building read-write technologies, precursor to Facebook, and the kids and educators went wild on that. And so I took a lot of ideas and started Synaptic Mesh and built end-to-end systems so that we could connect all the disparate data systems in school districts and states so that teachers, parents, and kids could see how they're progressing and really own their own learning.
And then Declara, this was actually a software that you were involved in creating the algorithm, yeah?
Yes. So Declara, when I was still had Synaptic Mesh, I had built an algorithm to look at how can we reschedule education so that we map teachers and students based on how kids learn best and how teachers teach best and connect them together. And we had profound changes in learning and happiness of educators who were actually teaching in ways that they were comfortable in. So I took a lot of that and brought it into Declara by thinking through more or less a Mobius strip. When we think about how we're going to transform students and we leave the educator out of the system, we do a disservice for education. And so Declara's been really focused on adult learning, and every country that brings us into learning, we're focused on teacher learning so that we can really focus the learning educators need to be successful in the classroom. And we use a lot of algorithms. So imagine having the best parts of Facebook where you have the social interactions and the best part of Google where you have search and recommendations, helping to create, with a learning overlay, helping to create a personalized learning pathway for you, so that not just having prescribed learning and adaptive learning, but really driving curiosity and intent into learning.
And again, let's get back to something you said before about taking the fragments of yourself. I mean, you learn to create kind of a cognitive map in your mm-hmm. head. You compare it to the Matrix, in fact.
Right. So very much like that in Declara, we are leveraging a cognitive graph so that we can personalize learning. So we look at personalized learning from the user's perspective instead of from a content perspective. In adaptive learning, you really understand the content and you branch out, you know, if-then statements. But what we're trying to do is really understand the intent, interest, and learning needs of people, and bringing the right resources, the right experts and mentors and content to people based on their learning trajectory.
Do you think of yourself as an educator or a technical or a person or an entrepreneur or all of the above?
First, I'm an educator and a learner. And so I can't tease those apart. Because I'm constantly in process of learning. And I think I'm all of the above, secondly, because to be a really good entrepreneur or technologist, you have to be a great learner and be a mentor and educator.
And this has become, I mean, Declara has become pretty much the software wide use in Australia and South America, as I understand it.
Yes. Yeah, so, and we just now moved into Singapore, so we're expanding on into Asia. And so we're the platform for all the educators in Australia and in Mexico. The world's largest teachers union is using our platform to help bring their teachers, retool the education system in Mexico.
And you got some millions of dollars from Peter Thiel, who would like to retool our education system and have people avoid college.
yes. I think he's thinking differently about college, though. I think he's thinking more on how do we bring lifelong learning so that we stop thinking about college as this place, that brick and mortar, where there's an obstacle in and an obstacle out, but we break down the brick and mortar and start really thinking about learning as being something we continually plug into.
We'll continue our discussion with Ramona Pearson. She's here with us in studio. She's CEO of Declara. They are a Palo Alto-based company. They use the tech platform of personalized learning. We're hearing her personal story here as well, which, as I said, is quite truly extraordinary. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Ramona Pearson with us as part of our first person series as we build it from coma patient to Silicon Valley executive. She was a 22-year-old Marine when she was hit by a drunk driver and landed in a coma. And when she woke up 18 months later, she was blind and unable to walk or to speak. And she went on to become a champion cyclist, a rock climber while she was still blind, and later regained her sight and became CEO of a startup, Declara, which develops technology for customized learning tools. And we're talking to her as part of our first-person series. And that series is really focusing on profiling Bay Area innovators and leaders who make our region unique. We talked a lot about what you went through physically and the amazing number of formidable challenges that you had. And I mean, like I say, it's a story that's really quite inspiring. But Let's talk about, psychologically, because, when you're talking just about, for example, crossing the street, you're talking about having PTSD, just hearing all the, like, say, a Marine coming back from, mines mm-hmm. going off or whatever, because you're blind, you can't see.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And when I first started to learn to cross the street, had it not been for the sense of humor of the senior citizens helping me get through that, and we were joking about the cane, and realistically, a few of my canes got broken and destroyed. But I think that what really helped me was having a guide dog. And still to this day, though, I struggle with, as I'm going to cross the street, if somebody's with me, I tend to pull them back. And I seem to have the, the old Marine Corps training where you want to protect everybody else. But the hardest part for me was not trying to interfere with the guide dog, because when you have a seeing eye dog, you have to allow the dog to protect you. So the dog will put itself between you and the car. And for me, that was the hardest part. And they weren't going to let me have the dog if I couldn't overcome my natural instinct of pulling Annie back and trying to protect her from cars. I had to 100% trust that she could take care of me.
And psychologically, adjusting to all these surgeries and all these obstacles to overcome and so forth, you may have given the key to your attitude before when you said, I just kept looking forward. I kept moving forward and didn't look back. That was Satchel Paige's advice, one of the great pitchers of all time, by the way, never look back. But to a great extent, you must have had to steel yourself, too, because not all these things were successful, and you just right. went on from one to the next.
Right. And you're exactly right. So most of the time, what I kept thinking was, I need to get back on my path, and that the path I'm on isn't where I need to be. And so I kept a very strong focus into working really diligently into moving forward. And I started, as I became stronger, I'd think about every surgery I'd prepare for as if I were preparing for the Olympics. I'd get as strong as I could physically and mentally so that it was my performance to have surgery and then recover. And then I learned to have certain tricks. I would have surgery on a Thursday because I knew I'd have to show back up into a graduate class on Monday. So I'd never allow myself time to feel sorry for myself or to get used to taking pain medicines, because I kept scheduling things that would drive me forward and kept me focused on the future. And so that became how I've lived my entire life.
Never any temptation to go into self-pity?
No time.
You didn't allow yourself the time.
Part of that is also if you've ever had a moment where your life has been taken away from you or nearly taken away from you, you realize you don't have time, that all of us, you don't need to have an accident come in to interfere with your forward momentum. But if you, all of us have such a short amount of time here and we have to make the most of it each and every day. And so any kind of opportunity that opens its door to me, I jump into feet first. Because that is an experience that I need to take. And we are here, and it's just an experiment, and it is for such a short amount of time, and we have to live our lives to the fullest.
I'm getting certainly a strong sense of your character and your nature, but let me, if I could, get you to talk about what nurtured all this. I know your background is Texas and Southern California, college, Marines. Marine Corps certainly does. I used to say the advertisement shapes men, but obviously shapes women, too, to a great extent. But I'm curious to know what the influences were in your life that shaped your kind of approach to life, your thinking, your attitudes.
I think a few things. One, the accident did make me realize that I had to make the most of my life. And then being in the senior citizens' home where so many people came together and focused on helping me become a productive person again, I have felt this need and desire to not just, pay it back, but pay it forward. and try to live my life in a way that is constantly trying to find out ways in which I can help other people find their path and to find their potential.
How did you find that senior center? I mean, it was sort of happenstance, wasn't it, or a little bit capricious?
Very capricious. You know, if you have an aging parent and you try to find facilities for your parents, you'll find that a lot of these facilities are full. And so this happened to be a facility that happened to have an opening. And because someone had recently died and, you know, the DAV pulled strings and I was able to be placed in this. And so it was just happenstance and my good fortune.
And let's get back to just what you've learned that you've applied to the business sector and that you've applied to a lot of the success you've had in the business sector about the importance of mentoring. I mean, it's key. And it was key for you in terms of your rehabilitation and reorientation into the world. But we keep hearing all kinds of different views about mentoring, and I'd like to hear yours.
You know, if you are going to learn to be a great cyclist, you can read a lot of books. Or you can connect with somebody who actually races bikes and ask them questions. And for the most part, you will learn a lot of things very quickly. So mentoring can be very effective if you are connected to the right people at the right time. So whenever I start a new company, I spend a lot of time being mentored and mentoring others. So Matt Ocko from Data Collective, who invested in our company, Peter Thiel, had opened themselves up to be mentors to me. Technologists along the path have opened up their doors to be mentors to me. So mentoring can be very powerful. But you're exactly right. If you are not being mentored by people that you trust, or that actually have the kinds of information that you need and the right steps, it can either be overwhelming or it can be not very useful.
Were you mentored? I mean, you were blind and became a bicyclist, when I hear more about that, as well as a rock climber. Mentored to do those things?
I was. You know, I can't remember the woman's name, but a woman who used to do, you know, the X climbing, you know, very crazy rock climbing. She met me in Colorado. She was a college student, and she said, "Hey, blind girl, you want to go rock climbing?" And I thought, well, what do I have to lose? So I've already been run over. So what's the worst that could happen? I could bounce off a rock. So she took me out rock climbing, and it felt like I was brailing a wall, so I could figure out the path that I was going to take by touching the rocks. And I have to also say that when you're blind, you spend so much time holding a cane or a person or a guide dog that the freeing experience of moving up a rock and guiding yourself tactily is the most exhilarating experience. Plus, when you're blind, you're not afraid of heights, so it was
But you
to
could
my
be
advantage.
Afraid of the rocks coming
yes.
down, right?
True, true. And then cycling.
And I should mention, you were named U.S. Master Cyclist of the Year in 1995. This is no small feat, but that the year you regained your sight, that was a year before that, you were riding tandem races with a sighted person. Yeah?
Yes. So, so along the way, in order to get my left leg to work again, and it was quite painful, a racer for Yeti Bikes had said, "Hey, why not get on the back of a tandem and I'll just force your leg around the pedal stroke?" So different cyclists would steer the front of the tandem bike and try to force the mobility of my leg, and it was quite painful. And then over time, as I started being able to bend my leg, I started becoming stronger and stronger, and very much enjoyed that experience. And, you know, finally somebody from the Master Cycling team had started coaching me and helped me become a better and better cyclist. And Glenn Winkle was a six-time World Cup champion, and he coached and steered me through World Cup championships in Austria.
More mentoring.
Yes.
We're talking again with Ramona Pearson. She is now CEO of Declara. They are a Palo Alto-based company that uses a tech platform to personalize learning. Let's talk some more about personalized learning with you. I mean, this is you've been doing things essentially also to take people and move them out of one. I mean, for example, farmers into other areas, that sort of thing. I mean, actually transpose them almost literally.
Yeah, you know, in Australia, so a lot of our countries around us are struggling with moving into knowledge-based industries. So in Australia, where the global warming has basically been decimating the agribusiness, and they're starting to see that some of the mining businesses are starting to come to the end, they're looking at how do we retool our entire workforce. And they're taking on a two-pronged approach. One is changing the education system, and so changing how teachers teach. And so we've started there working with educators, a very bottom-up movement where the educators are driving the learning instead of the country. And it's been amazing to see new content and curriculum rolling out there.
You're really readjusting the economy here to the different economy, yeah?
Exactly. And then you have an entire population that's having to retool themselves so that they move into a new economy. And that's happening rapidly throughout the rest of the world, in Latin America specifically.
Whether we could do that with all these people who work in coal or fossil fuel into alternative energies here.
Exactly. You know, and I think about it, think about all of the jobs that are open. I have to double the size of my engineering staff, and a lot of companies worldwide are trying to fill all of these jobs, but there aren't enough people in the workforce that can fill those jobs. And so you think, well, there are millions of Americans that are out of jobs. Why aren't we helping to retool them so that they can be connected with all of these open jobs?
I'm thinking, just as we're talking here, I mean, we're having rich conversation, we're giving eye contact with each other, making gestures, body language, and all that sort of thing. These are the kinds of things you also had to relearn after your blindness?
Yeah, you know, when I was blind, I would rock a little bit, not too much, and it was because I lost social context. And even now when I look in the mirror, I notice that because I don't see out of my right eye, it droops a little bit, and I have to sometimes think, oh, I have to blink that eye or do something. And when I first got my sight back, I used to lean on walls or people on my left side because I was used to having a guide dog or a cane, and tend to sort of walk off to the side. And, you know, even in cycling, because I'm blind on my right side, all the women would yell, well, blind girl in the pack, because I'd run anybody off on the right side. So I still have some weirdness in my behaviors, and I tend to hug everybody and hold people. So when I was working in the hospital, I could feel people's, you know, their emotions by holding their arms. And so when you're blind, you tend to stand closer and hold on to people. So it gives you a lot of clues into, you know, how someone's feeling. And once you have sight, everybody backs off away from you. And so at first I was a little lonely because all of a sudden the social distance became quite large and I had to reteach myself to back away from people.
Did you also find, obviously because of your bicycling and so forth, very competitive. I mean, you have strong competitive spirit. Did you mm-hmm. find that was dampened when you were blind and when you were going through all of the rehabilitation you were going through?
No, not at all. In fact, it drove me more because I wanted to, when I went back to college, a lot of the colleges were fighting about me even going to college. Because they'd say, well, less than 1% of the people will ever who are blind will finish college. And I literally had professors that would reject me being in their class, and I'd talk to them personally and say, if I'm not the top student in your class by the mid-quarter, you can kick me out. But so I had to constantly compete to show that I deserve to be in that classroom, or I deserve to be in
college.
What
kind of classes did they want to kick you out of because you were blind?
Well, statistical classes, a lot of the computer science classes, yeah. and a lot of the classes where they felt, you know, there were stigmas around somebody who was differently abled being able to compete, especially. I had to create some of the new technologies to be in those classes because this is a time where your computers didn't speak to you. We had to actually leverage Berkeley Labs around DeckTalk and VocalEyes, and I'd have to invent ways to emboss my writing right on the spot so that the teachers could see it and I could feel it.
So you became an inventor, too.
I mean, exactly.
Technology inventor. Ramona Pearson with the CEO of Declara, and her personal story is, as I said, a remarkable one. We're hearing that. We're also hearing about the work she's done. Do you think CEOs are too overpaid? It's a big issue with many people, as you know, probably.
You know, startup CEOs tend to not get paid anything. So,
and work like dogs.
Yes, 24/7. So,
but, you know, there's Silicon Valley CEOs who are making, you know, extraordinary sums of money, astronomical sums of money, with companies sometimes that aren't even that profitable.
Yeah, you know, I think all of that has to be tempered through the board. So if you have a board that you trust and that you brought in, they will hold you accountable to meeting your numbers, and will hold you accountable for having your salary be in line with where it needs to be. And so I tend to not be paid as well as the rest of the people in my company. So, and as a CEO, I tend to not get paid for the first few years of the company's life. So...
Does your personal story, has it helped you, you think, in terms of running companies or startups, or also getting venture capital? I mean, when people know the story, probably one of the most immediate responses is to feel admiration, sympathy, those kinds of things.
No, you know, for me, failure isn't an option. So the Marine Corps part of me is sort of like...
But you learn from failure.
Yeah. There are different types of failure, but the grit, the tenaciousness, some, you know, really driving your company forward. When you're a CEO, you have to be able to go through the good, the bad, the ugly, and stay completely calm and know that you can come up with the solution and that you will persevere and make it to the end.
I don't in any way put myself in your league. However, recently I had an experience where I was pretty ill, and I had to come in and do a show, and I was being celebrated that night for my 20 years in public radio, and I just said, show must go on, you know, that kind of attitude.
Yeah.
And I was comparing myself to a talk show host I knew years ago, whose name won't be mentioned, but was one of the major talk show hosts in this market who... I'm not entirely exaggerating when I say he would stay out when he had, you know, a hangnail, or, you know, his thumb hurt him or something like that. I mean, I wonder what you feel when you have people who say, you know, I'm going through so much now and so forth. I mean, because most of it pales in comparison to what you've been through. And most of it is pretty minor. And I'm not exalting you here. I'm just stating what I see as the fact here. And so you sometimes feel that sort of attitude, like, who the hell are they to complain?
You know, it's interesting. You know, you'll have somebody who can persevere through anything, and then sometimes people struggle with some things that we may perceive to be minor, but to them it's very emotionally disruptive. And so I think we all have a different set of capabilities, and some of us are you know, have this grit, and it may be how we were raised, and have this sense that we can persevere through things, and other people may not have that. And so it's really understanding and giving empathy to people based on their personality types.
Let's go back to relearning. I mean, you must have learned some pretty substantial things about how people relearn. And again, there's a broad continuum, I'm sure. You know, some people relearn better than others. They adapt very well. They're very versatile that way. Other people, they're in mothballs, and it's quite difficult. But what kind of generalizations have you come to?
You know, when I had to relearn, I had severe TBI, so a traumatic brain injury. And so when I see, there are parts of you I don't see because there are aspects of the brain that have been damaged. And so it's not just the physical aspect of my eye itself. So I had to really learn how to take the weaknesses in my brain and understand those and the strengths of the different lobes and be able to leverage those to really reorganize the dendrites and really reorganize how I was going to recover. So I also not just struggle with a speech problem that was physically caused, but also having a traumatic brain injury. I have part of the brain. So I have to actually think a little bit longer than most people to speak. So I have learned how to speak in a different rate in order to get the right words. I also suffer from paraphasia, so I might grab the wrong word periodically. You know, I might be talking about my bike and call it a washing machine, and, you know, people look at you a little strange, but I just keep going. So all of us may have a different way of learning, but the bottom of the conversation is that we all have these strengths. And if we really understand the person, we can design a learning pathway that goes through a bit of a trial and error and learns the best way in which you learn. And that's what we try to do in Declara, is really customize the learning experience for you. And in education, a lot of times we're trying to make kids or adults adapt to education instead of having education adapt to the adults or the kids. And so we try to do that.
When you say we all have these strengths, something in me resists that notion because, again, your resilience is pretty distinctive. You're talking about reorganizing your dendrites. I mean, most people don't even think that way.
Yeah, I'm a little metacognitive, but I've been forced to have to think about thinking. And some of us don't do that naturally. And I really believe that if people understood how they think, if they become more cognitive, they can be better learners because they'd understand more of their strengths and how to leverage those strengths to compensate for weaknesses and to even leverage those weaknesses.
So neuroscience has been a major part, not only for you personally, but professionally.
Yes, it has.
And do you think adults learn in a different way than children?
Absolutely. Adults learn differently because we're distracted by so many things. We may diagnose a child with ADD or ADHD, but in reality, adults are more ADD than anything. So when we're trying to help an adult retool their skills or be able to level up their skills to get a new job, we're having to compete with the fact that they're thinking about their kids getting to school, that they have to go grocery shopping, they have bills to pay, they have to go to work, they have to finish work, they've got to deal with a supervisor and a gazillion things in not just learning. And when you're working with kids, hopefully their sole job is learning. And so we're having to really think through how do we help people learn quickly in very focused ways.
And you've also obviously given a good deal of thought to helping the disabled learn to a
yes.
greater degree and learn with more acuity and more speed and so forth. What are some of the methods that you feel are most effective?
You know, a lot of that is really getting to understand who the user is or learner
Customize, as you said before.
Yeah. You know, we look at how people search, what their intent and interests are. We have little cognitive markers in our platform that help us really revalidate some of the assumptions we have because there are contextual differences in learning. So your context for learning something for work is different than your context for learning something for your personal edification versus something you need for your home or kids. So having to switch context and understand also with different challenges people bring into learning or the workforce allows us to understand context of learning.
Can you give us some of your wisdom? I feel like I'm, you know, in this Colorado home because you're a source and a font of wisdom in some ways, just about how you can get yourself to concentrate more on whatever the task of learning is at hand, as opposed to having your mind stray about all those other things that adults tend to think about that you said.
You know, all of that is around engagement. Really finding, we try to help people learn through the things they're most interested in. If you're trying to learn statistics and you love baseball, why wouldn't we combine those? So there's ways that we can look at combining those pieces so that you're engaged in your own learning and that you're also learning through things that bring curiosity.
Curiosity is probably one of the best means,
yes,
or vehicles to learning. I mean, certainly I'm learning all the time. It's one of the great things about this job, and has the real fulcrum is my curiosity.
Yeah, you know, curiosity is interesting because we tend to pull that out of learning, and that's actually what allows people to really come up with novel thought. And when we engage people to be thinkers and contributors of knowledge, they become more curious and more engaged in their own learning.
Well, it's an amazing story, your personal story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us today, and ongoing success to you.
Thank you so very much.
Again, Ramona Pearson, she's CEO of Declara. They're a Palo Alto-based company that uses a tech platform to personalize learning. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Howard Gelman, and we get online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.